Hello, hello. This is Beyond Organic Wine, and it's a podcast. And I'm Adam Huss, coming to you from a rainy day in San Benito County, California. And I'm going to jump right in and say, I'm trying to change things up and maybe shorten these intros. You probably, if you've been listening to this podcast, heard enough of me. So let me just say, the one thing that won't change is my gratitude for those of you who listen and for those of you who contribute and make this podcast possible. I love the community aspect of what is happening with this podcast, and I'm so grateful to be part of it, and I'm so grateful that you are all part of it. So thank you very much. And now, for this episode, I want to introduce Josh and Charlie of Sylvan Farm and Cidery. They do such an excellent job of introducing themselves and their story that I just think it would be redundant for me to pre-introduce them here, but I will tempt you to listen on by saying that they talk about harvesting wildish fruit. I mean, you know, wild is an illusion, right? So maybe feral is more accurate, and making wine cider from it, or cider wine, or just cider, or just wine, or whatever you really care about in terms of terminology. Just stuff that grows out of the ground and they ferment it. They talk about queer ecology and the living and growing on the feral side of agriculture. They talk about how they're integrating tree breeding and selection and adaptive unfarming. Maybe they don't actually use that word, but that's essentially what they're doing. They're incorporating all this into their orchard program, if you want to call it an orchard program. It's more like a let it grow and take care of it program. And they talk about what they've learned from getting this thing started over the past couple of years, which I think is incredibly valuable for anybody who's starting out and thinking about doing something like this. Sylvan Farm and Cidery is new, and I love the ideas and intentions behind it and through it, and that embody Josh and Charlie, because I think we'll all be able to learn some really valuable things along with these guys as they explore these ideas in their farming and in their cidery. Oh, and they may be making some of the most deliciously interesting perry that comes from a grove of wild feral slash whatever trees that may actually just be one tree, like one super organism tree connected by a single root system under the ground magically. One of my favorite ideas and things and organisms are things that might make fruit from a huge system of interconnectedness like that. And so this perry that they make actually embodies that in flavor and in a fermented beverage that can elevate your spirit. So very excited for you to hear that from them and what they're doing with everything else that they're doing, and for us to all taste this first vintage very soon. So enjoy. Where are you? Can you talk about where you guys are?
Yeah, we're at our farm in the Finger Lakes in upstate New York. We're sitting here with our candles.
Candles because Charlie loves the ambiance.
Getting us in the mood for a nice conversation.
Yes.
Your farm is called Sylvan Farm and Cidery, right?
Yes, that's correct.
Can you guys talk about why you named your farm Sylvan Farm and Cidery?
Yeah, for sure. We spent a really long time pondering all kinds of different names and thinking about whether we wanted something that was more descriptive or family oriented or evocative. And we finally kind of came upon the word Sylvan, in part because the literal meaning is that it's as of or pertaining to the forest. And because we are growing apples and other tree crops, we felt like that was really appropriate. But then we kind of went back into the history of where that word actually comes from. And it's derived from an ancient Roman deity, Sylvanus, who was the protector of forests and wild places. You know, you have like Pomona, where we get palm fruits from. And she was the goddess of orchards and more kind of protected and human influenced spaces, I guess I would say. And then Sylvanus was a little bit more of a uncultivated
yes.
deity.
Wilder.
Yeah. And then it also turned out that he had a male lover. So there was a whole gay storyline there that we really related to.
Yeah.
We're jumping straight into queer queer ecology here. So it checked a lot of boxes in terms of both the kind of forest imagery and that what we are doing and the way that we're approaching our fruit growing is to emulate forests and healthy forest ecosystems and forest edges, and are sort of approaching it from a little bit more wild perspective. And then there was this sort of beautiful, mythical gay love story as well.
Yeah.
Josh, you have more
amazing.
Yeah. I mean, I think Charlie hit the high points. We also did some deep diving to make sure there weren't any like bad parts to his story. And lo and behold, he seems to be one of the better characters when you go back into Roman gods. So
yeah,
we were like, okay, this works.
Yeah, he didn't do anything really horrible.
Yeah. So.
Why did you land on the side of the wilder, uncultivated spaces rather than, you know, the Pomona side of things?
That's a really good question.
I would say, as Charlie's partner, it probably, for Charlie especially, resonated with his youth. We do live on a beautiful piece of land and a lot of wild spaces, and I think Charlie definitely got that experience in life, where a lot of us don't. And so that kind of has been a guiding light for a lot of the way that we're trying to set up our farming practices and the experience people might have when they come to our property. You know, keeping things a little more wild, a little more diversified, you know, approaching it from that point of view.
Yeah. And I think for you too, I mean, our sort of whole approach to farming is a little bit more to take the assumption that the way that nature has evolved to work for a really long time is functional and valuable and what we actually need to be learning from. So I think the idea that sort of wild landscapes are chaotic or unkempt or need to be tamed isn't necessarily the approach that we're coming to it from, but that these are places that have developed their own kind of harmony and balance. And then specifically to our landscape, we just have a ton of wild, or you could say feral or naturalized apple trees. They're, you know, ultimately not native, but have been here for a really long time and have been growing successfully for a really long time outside of any kind of very well-organized orchard context. And so I think when we were approaching what we wanted to do, we aren't as drawn to an extremely structured, intensive orchard where, say, we're growing dwarf trees on trellises that look very similar to traditional vineyards and mowing and spraying. We are more interested in full-size trees growing in biologically diverse ways. So I think the idea of a thriving forest made more sense to us than the idea of an orchard, even though orchards are beautiful and glorious, and Pomona is awesome too.
Oh yeah.
Very well said. Did you want anything, Josh?
Well, it's funny. So part of kind of coming to this land has been the, you know, realization / Charlie's uncles, who also live on this greater family farm property, you know, kind of told us when we arrived that there are a lot of apples just growing wild in the fields, like small sprouts coming up. And that could be, you know, a resource for us. And we didn't really know what to make of that at the time. I especially didn't, because I'm newer to the property. And so we ended up planting what you would think of as maybe more of the classic European style orchard, full-size trees, larger spacing. And then as we spent time observing the land and really paying attention to it, we did start to notice all of these wild trees. So we commonly joke now that if we could do it all over, we might have just paid more attention to those wild trees, protected those, and let them grow where they were already, you know, living.
And that's not to say that we wouldn't have grafted onto those trees, or we wouldn't have intervened in certain ways, but just that the cow pastures and hay fields are already full of little baby seedling trees that just want to grow and are popping up. And so rather than buying rootstocks, it would have been really cool to work a little bit more with what was just kind of already happening there, I guess.
Yeah. And you guys are actually putting little cages around them, right? Some of the ones that you're finding.
Exactly. We have pretty intense deer pressure up here on our farm. So much so that it's like, you know, the plants that people say deer won't eat typically get eaten. So in this one specific section of the farm, we are creating our own kind of experiment station, which harkens back to a lot of the, you know, history with apple breeding and apple growing. And so far I've caged around 58 apple seedling trees that are just growing wild in the field. And, you know, I think last year when I was observing this, I was kind of in disbelief. I was like, are these really all apple trees? And we had friends in the area, like we showed them pictures and they were like, yeah, those are apples. And it really became apparent because of some of the droughts we've had. And these are, you know, trees that maybe are only a foot or two tall, but never needed an ounce of water during those droughts. So it became even more clear that these are trees that we should utilize because they've already got a taproot reaching some level of moisture underground and just want to grow. So we're doing our best to protect them from deer this year. And
there really are hundreds and hundreds of those trees scattered throughout the fields that have just been kind of nibbled down by the deer that Josh was talking about that are sort of a huge problem here for like the forest succession. And maybe they've been mowed by my family at different times as well.
Right. And so,
I think you could grow a massive orchard just by protecting them from harm.
Mm-hmm. They probably, you know, when you coppice like that, like, you know, I mean, essentially it's like a coppiced potential apple orchard that, you know, has been coppiced by, you know, inadvertently or, you know, totally advertently by the deer, but not with the intention to grow the roots. But what happens is you actually create like this incredible root structure as long as it's, you know, allowed to get some photosynthetic life to feed the roots, you know, before it gets totally munched away. And so you could, you know, once you protect them, they could just shoot up. Like you could have this, all this potential energy. I've also heard some really amazing things about the benefits of growing these plants from seed in on site, you know, in situ, that is kind of revolutionary once you start doing it, like what they nutritionally do. I mean, because you're essentially, they're like weeds and, you know, they're there for a reason. They're like filling a niche and they're doing all kinds of things because they're meant to be there. You know, the reason they germinated in that spot was for all these different things that were happening in the soil and their own appropriateness for that spot. So it's, I don't know, there's something really exciting about that for me as well.
Better watch out, because that's one of Josh's favorite topics.
Yeah, so I mean, I'm happy to talk about the little bit that we've started to do with that exact concept, which is our first year here, we were able to make a perry from some pear trees on a different place on the farm. And I was pretty adamant that we take all of that pomace from the pears and put it onto our land in specific areas. And, you know, lo and behold, last year I had a few seedlings popping up that I observed and have put cages around those. So, you know, I think a big push for me as the next generation of orcharding or fruit breeding is to be planting seeds and see how those perform and hopefully find new varieties that do well in our climate and produce good fruit for making ciders and perries. So,
and to be fair, I think that's something that we learned from some of the people we've worked with, like Autumn at Gives and other folks like that. But to your point specifically, Adam, about like growing things from seed rather than transplanting as well. I know, Josh, you talk a lot about how like the disruption to the roots, you know, most trees that are grown in orchards have been planted in nursery, wrenched from the ground, and then put in somewhere else. and have, you know, right. oftentimes haven't had the ability to develop the same types of root systems, and especially like the deep tap roots, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah, I mean, if you right. think about the process of most apples you'll buy in a store, they've been cut from a rootstock stool bed, planted, and then grafted onto into a nursery, and then typically planted, you know, once again somewhere else to grow to a certain size and then dug up. So they go through a lot. And so being able to plant from seed in situ, like you were saying, Adam, really does, you know, if you can get them established from seed, then you really do have a tree that's going to thrive, it seems.
And I think a lot of these ones in the field right here are because they've had years and years to build that root system.
Yes. We're seeing what you're saying, which is because they were protected last year, they have shot up, and it's pretty exciting.
Yeah.
Amazing.
Excited to see what happens.
That's great. Well, speaking of that pear and that Perry, I think I got to try it. Is that right?
You did. Yes. I think you tried twice. Yeah.
I still talk about it. It was one of my favorite Perrys of my life.
Oh, and thank you.
So good. Well, it was also just a lovely, everything about coming up to the farm and hanging out with you guys was lovely. Also, speaking of the Sylvan wildness of things, that you served us wild food, served Wendy and I some wild food that you had gathered, some milkweed spears that were delicious. Yes. And now I eat milkweed. I've become a milkweed evangelist, like everywhere I go on the East Coast.
That's fantastic. You guys tried
milkweed? That ecological knowledge is fantastic. I mean, like, this is being able to eat from your land from wild foods is, like, I think really important. And that Perry was made from essentially a single tree, wasn't it?
Yeah, I want to make clear, we haven't DNA tested all these trees, so we can't 100% confirm that they are one organism, but all the fruit, has the same sugar levels, the kind of same perceptible qualities. It's all from kind of this little grove of trees, and they are unusual for pears because they send out all these roots that then kind of sucker up, you know, sprout up little baby pears that we've also been digging up and transplanting to our land as well. And so it appears to be just kind of one grove that is connected by a single root system. And it's been one of the coolest discoveries for us on the farm, because it's in a hedgerow at the bottom of my childhood sledding hill. And these are pears that, you know, they're like chalky, and they really don't taste very good to eat. So they were something we like totally ignored. And then when we had learned, you know, a little bit more about the type of fruit that made really good cider, we got really excited about them. And they were one of the few, you know, trees that fruited the first year that we were here. And then they also fruited the second year that we were here as well, which is pretty unusual also for, you know, completely untended fruit trees. And and they've just, in both years, I think you tasted the Perry from our first year. Mm-hmm. And we now have a second vintage that I would say is even better. So it's just been like a really cool discovery.
Yeah. In fact, the second vintage, we in the first year we harvested maybe a little earlier than we needed to, just because it was unfamiliar fruit. We didn't want, you know, them to all fall and the animals to get to them first. So the second year we waited a little longer, and you know, it was really complex flavors and a pretty good palate. So we actually have bottled the second vintage as a still Perry.
Mm-hmm.
So we're pretty excited to share that with the world soon.
Yeah.
Wow.
It came out
I've never
super
had...
clear and kind of minerally. It was really nice.
Mm-hmm.
That's amazing. Is that the one that's coming out soon?
Yes. So that's what we've bottled as of this year. And then we are working on a sparkling Perry as well. And that's made with some of those pears and then additional pears that we've gathered from the land as well. That's also really good, you know, good tannins and such. but we thought it would be better with some, you know, some carbonation. And then we also are doing a bunch of apple-based, you know, ciders this year as well.
I mean, the dream is we're shooting for mid to late spring.
Yeah, we're getting there. Nice. We'll let everybody know and kind of have a kickoff.
Understood. No rush. If I'm not mistaken, I saw a post from you guys that you were up in a pear tree today or recently.
I like spending as much time as possible up in pear trees. I think that specific picture you saw was a pear tree that is out in the woods on a part of our farm that belongs to my uncle. And we were actually gathering some scion wood from that to graft onto some of the small pears, the pear rootstocks that we have, because that pear tree seemed to have some really great acid qualities. And that's one of the things that we felt like our Perry blends could benefit from going forward would be to have a little bit more higher acid fruit. Mm-hmm. So that tree, you know, it was kind of out in the middle of the forest. It was being shaded out. It had also been damaged by what we think was a porcupine, which loves to eat the underbark off trees, especially fruit trees, seemingly. Yeah. I had climbed up there, I think, to cut some scion from that we can then graft.
Before it dies, you mean?
Yeah.
Probably before it dies. It doesn't seem, it's not really in a place that is super accessible. And so it's probably not one that it's very practical for us to really clear out around the way that we have been in some other parts of the farm, mm-hmm. where we're also trying to rehabilitate a lot of the older wild trees that are there. So we're kind of doing a two-pronged thing where we're trying to rehabilitate as many of the trees as we can that make sense and learn about their fruit and whether the fruit has qualities that we want to use for cider. And then also taking scion from those trees as well and bringing that into the orchard that we are kind of planting and managing a little bit more, whether that's rootstocks that we've purchased already or baby apple trees that were kind of growing wild in the fields that we are grafting some other varieties onto.
Yeah, I love that. And speaking of grafting, you are doing that with some hawthorns too, is that correct? With apples?
Oh,
hawthorns,
yeah.
And apples.
Yes, that's been another really, really fun thing. So part of the, you know, the landscape is some of these kind of successional fields that are, close to 100 years ago, they were pastures that have slowly been growing back. And so we have a ton of these hawthorn trees that are compatible with not apple necessarily, but are primarily, we've been grafting quince and medlar onto those trees.
Oh.
And so that's been kind of a way for us to, like, rather than just taking out those hawthorns, which, you know, in general are not super useful to us, like you can utilize the established root system that's, you know, built up over the last 50 years, let's say, and these massive trunks, and then just crown graft them over to quince, which is like an amazing fruit for making cider with, or medlar, which we don't really know much about, but I would love to learn more about, both as something that we can eat and then potentially also ferment as well. So that has seemed to work really well. We did most of the grafting on hawthorn last year, and we've had some really great success with that, of really happy and healthy quince, especially growing on that.
Beautiful. I don't know if I mentioned this when I was there with you, if the topic of hawthorn came up, but I don't know if you know Diana Beresford Kroger, but if you've read any of her writings about the hawthorn, it according to her is a pretty special tree. And one of its special properties, not only like it, it's got mythical import, but it also actually has very amazing health importance, healthful benefits, in that it is beneficial for your heart, for your heart health. Did I mention that to you guys?
I think I do remember you mentioning that. And I think through some of my, you know, diving into the archives of more about hawthorns, that's come across, you know, in various ways. I think, you know, luckily we still have so many hawthorns left to experiment with. Also because they have great tannic qualities. So I think there's opportunity there to add some interesting tannins to some of our ciders.
Again, another Instagram post. I'm sorry I'm bringing up Instagram posts, but it moved me because you were schlepping a wheelbarrow full of stuff around and you were talking about having a zero fossil fuel farm, fueled farm. Can you talk about that? Is that a real thing? What's going on?
I think on the one hand, that was pretty tongue in cheek. You know, we use our little pickup truck and we borrow equipment, but we, on the one hand, do want to minimize our use of equipment as much as possible. And we've talked about ways to utilize animals like sheep for grazing to replace doing as much mowing as we would have to do. But I think really that was sort of a hopefully friendly and silly way to talk about some of the ways in which natural wine, which I think we are referencing there, sometimes seems to focus very much on, like, you know, cellar practices, like 00 when it comes to sulfur or bentonite, but not so much on, you know, environmental practices. So that, like, the real goal, like the more important goal, is probably your, you know, fuel usage. And I mean, even more than that, like the way you treat your agricultural workers, if you have any, but your fuel usage and your environmental practices, rather than your cellar practices. So I think it was kind of a goofy way of getting at that. But yes, that is a dream of ours as well.
There should be many more zeros than the two zeros that are mentioned in when you talk about 00 wine. There's way more zeros than that need to be talked about.
Oh, yeah. I know we've talked about, so, you know, could we, like, let's say we had a donkey cart to move our apples. And could we set up a cidery that used a lot more, gravity feeding and siphoning and that kind of thing? I mean, on the other hand, we're also, you know, beholden to the capitalist system in which we live and the need to survive. So there's some kind of balance there, but that's definitely something we daydream about.
Of course. Definitely. Yeah. No, I mean, it's like asking the question and aiming for that kind of gives you these creative ideas about, like, you're not going to reach that, but I think asking how you might, if you really, like, what the real answers would be if you tried to, what would that mean? Like, I mean, I'd love to know, because it sounds like you guys are doing so many different things. Like, you're establishing your farm, and you're just at the beginning. And for anybody who's in that position, or about to be in that position, like, I'm asking for a friend, of course.
Yes.
but for anybody who is thinking about this, like, what has been working for you? Like, what have you learned in this process? Because I know it's, you know, it's all consuming, and you guys have really, you've been having off-farm jobs to be able to, like, pay the bills and make things work. And so what are you finding are the realities? What do you hate? What do you love? Any advice and recommendation?
Josh, you want to jump on that?
Such a great question, Adam. Wow. Yeah. Where do you begin with such scope? So I definitely feel like, you know, for two people that had kind of previous lives, previous careers, and have now decided in their, you know, mid to late 30s to jump into doing a project like this. I think one of the things that typically is at the front of our mind is we're not getting enough done. Like, we are constantly feeling like, you know, we need to be doing more and working more, spending more time doing these projects. Luckily, we have people like you and friends and family who are visiting the farm and are just kind of amazed at what we're doing and, you know, point out all the projects, and you kind of take a step back and are able to take a breath and be like, okay, yeah, this is actually, we're doing what we set out to do. We're not falling behind. We still have time. But yeah, I guess advice for people, you know, we left this previous kind of career path to do something that we were a little more passionate about. I think we both have been thriving in agriculture and, you know, doing hard labor outdoors, working with our hands, being able to collaborate on these projects together. So it's brought a lot of meaning to our lives in ways that maybe wasn't there in the past. I think it's a lot about kind of like trusting the process, especially the way we've decided to approach growing apples. We're not doing dwarf trees where you see apples in 3 years. The trees we planted 2 years ago, we probably won't see a real crop for another 6 years. So it's a marathon and not a sprint. It's been interesting. We're starting year three, and just today we were pruning a tree on Charlie's parents' land, and to see the changes we had made for the past 2 years, you know, this third year, we're starting to see like a new form and a new shape. And I don't know, you really get to live in a way that like is in sync with nature and this ebb and flow of the things that we're doing to coax things along in a direction that's hopefully, you know, fruitful for the future of our business and all of us that live on this beautiful family land. It's pretty magical. So I would say, as much stress as it is, because at the end of the day, it's up to us to do these things because it's our small business and we are working a job off the farm and trying to have a social life at the same time, it's like so worth it. It's really been something that we're very passionate about, and like exciting to do a podcast like yours where we get to, you know, hopefully inspire more people our age or people younger than us to do something similar, because it, I don't know, it's brought a lot of meaning to our lives that's fun to share with the world, I would say. Feel free to chime into.
No, I think that's totally right. On like that personal level, it's been a hugely like life-giving thing for us. I think in terms of advice, I'm like super leery to give any advice because we are just starting out on this project. But I would say one thing is that we have benefited massively from people who have, you know, who do have a lot of wisdom, who have, you know, years and years and years of doing this. So like, you know, we've both worked for farms in the past. You know, we met working on a farm, on an apple farm in California. And then I was lucky enough to intern with Autumn Stoshek at Eve Cidery for a year. And that was an invaluable resource. So I literally cannot imagine jumping into something like this without having done that internship. And then from that, also having people like Autumn and, you know, other cider makers and winemakers in the area as mentors and collaborators. So I think having really that like collaborative community aspect has been so huge. And then also my family here and just like family support, Josh's family too, but more presently because we're living with my family. I think unfortunately there's like, you know, maybe especially on social media, there can be like a very idealistic picture presented of like, you know, homesteading or small business or like, you know,
cottagecore,
you know, running. So, and like, we're extremely lucky to have access to this family land, you know, this farm that my grandparents originally bought and then my aunts and uncles added to, that, you know, they've been really generous, my parents too, and like allowing us to gather that, you know, to forage fruit essentially. So we've been able to gather a huge amount of apples just from within a mile of our cidery. which has been really awesome.
Right.
And so I definitely don't want to underplay the luck in having those kinds of resources, because there's that whole sort of economic side as well. Mm-hmm. You know, and we are working off farm jobs, and that certainly slows down the process, but we've also intentionally made the choice to really try to self-finance things, because we don't want to be in a place where having massive loans sort of pushes us to like compromise our values in ways that we don't want to. Values both in terms of like the product that we're putting out there. Like, we don't want to have to buy fruit that we don't actually grow or forage ourselves. And we don't want to sell cider that we don't actually really believe in and think is delicious and interesting and intriguing. And we don't want to engage in farming practices that we aren't comfortable with. And so we don't want to get in a position where we simply have to, you know, pay our bills and do whatever it takes to do that. But it's also a huge amount of luck to even be able to do anything like this in the first place.
So,
wow, that was a very rambling answer to your question. I have one more thing that I would say, which is really just to like take it slow. I think, you know, on the one hand, when you're doing something that feels like a big risk, like starting a cidery and, you know, leaving your previous career to do that, you do just have to take the leap at some point, even knowing that you don't know enough, and you just start. On the other hand, there are things that we've realized, you know, maybe a year of living on this land would have put us in a better position to make a plan than jumping straight into, say, planting an orchard as soon as we got here. Is that fair?
Right.
Yeah, it's definitely fair. And then if I'm going to chime in a little bit on some other, I don't know, it's definitely not sage advice, but things I think we have learned along the way, which is, you know, some of the costs developing any kind of agricultural system on your land can be quite high if you are purchasing pre-established trees or plants. But something I've really gotten into, and I think is just more exciting in general, is to do a lot of it from seed yourself. Or like our orchard that we planted the first year, we decided to, you know, only plant rootstock the first year, which is way cheaper. It's like, you know, $3 to $4 a stem versus a $30 established tree. And then to graft those trees the second year in situ. And then we've already seen trees, you know, by the end of their second growing season that are close to the size of a newly purchased tree. And so you're saving a lot of money that way. I've been trying to grow a lot of nut trees and other plants for us from seed, just because, you know, they'll be better established on our land, and the price point is just way better. So, you know, if you're willing to take that slow start,
if you feel like you have the time,
yeah, then you can really, you know, edge off some of that financial burden in the beginning. You just have to be patient.
Yes. Which we are not very patient. We don't like it.
Spend some good Taoist practice.
It seems like the better approach.
No, that sounds great. I mean, I feel that as well. Like, I never wanted to live for very long until I started thinking about farming trees.
Yeah.
And I was like, trees, I'm going to need another 100 years to be able to see these.
I know.
Yeah.
Something we talk about a lot is how farming trees and working with trees just changes our view of time and time scales, because you're working on like a once every year harvest, and you're working with organisms that are going to outlive you. Mm-hmm. Hopefully. I mean, for sure. Mm-hmm. They should outlive you. Or we're harvesting fruit from trees that are far older than you.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Now, one of the things, one of the features of your farm that I really personally like is that area that you have fenced off as a nursery to start things, which I've intentionally in the project that I'm working on, I want to, or any farm that I want to work on, if I'm in control, I would like to have there be a section that is meant for breeding new varieties of the things that we're growing, whatever it is, whether it's, you know, prickly pears or pears. And I love that you guys have that.
Yeah. So that is, oh, go ahead. What's your
question? What inspired that?
Oh gosh. So what inspired that? I like to joke that it's the inner artist in me, because that's my previous life before getting into, you know, hands-on farming. I think there's a beauty in kind of, whether it's planting open pollinated things and kind of just carrying on things that nature is doing on its own, or I've really been into following this guy out in Mendocino County in California, Stephen Edholm, I believe is his name. He goes by Skill Cult on Instagram and YouTube, and he's carrying on a lot of like apple breeding projects from Albert Edders, who was very focused on red fleshed apples. So it's definitely struck a chord with me in almost an obsessive way that I think Charlie laughs at all the time, because he's like, I don't know if we have time for all this. And I'm just like, it's just, you know, you do it once a year and it's worth it, because you're getting to, you know, put new genetics into the world that hopefully, you know, help farmers along the way. But yeah, what you're referencing, what you saw when you visited, is what we're now calling Sylvania, just because we needed to give it a name. And yeah,
that's it's better than the name that I was thinking of for it.
So yeah, there's a lot of apple and pear happening there, but we also have started growing a lot of nut trees from seed. I've got some persimmon and pawpaw going, and
fantastic.
Numerous amounts of native flowers and plants that hopefully will help live alongside the apple trees and, you know, attract the beneficial insects. And we're really just trying to diversify the land as much as possible. So doing that by harvesting seed from local thriving trees and plants seemed like the logical way to go for me. So that's what I've been kind of focused on.
One other aspect of that for me, sort of focusing more on the cider and the cider making side of things, is that a lot of the best traditional apples for cider making from France and England are particularly susceptible to fire blight and other diseases that are more common in the States. And so there's a real need to be developing more indigenous varieties, you know, cider apples that can actually thrive here, because our goal is to not be spraying and to, you know, not be having to, you know, kind of manage in that way, to try to develop apple varieties that can, you know, thrive with a little less intervention, I guess. Mm-hmm. And there are other people in the Finger Lakes who are already doing that, in terms of gathering scion from wild trees and, you know, sort of naming and developing new varieties. And so I think that's been a huge inspiration for us, is sort of those other people who are doing that for cider apples. And then I think for Josh particularly, to also be not just discovering things that are already out there in the wild, but also kind of more intentionally cross-pollinating and breeding things, apple varieties in this case, that could be replacements for some of the more fire blight susceptible cider varieties that we're kind of forced to rely on now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I love all of that. And it makes me think, I mean, I know you guys have some experience on farms. You know, Charlie, you're from that area and have spent your whole life there off and on, mostly on. But I bet since you are immersing yourself in this way, you're being exposed to the ecology of that place in a new way. And I would love to hear if I'm right in guessing that, but and if so, what you're learning and how it's influencing, you know, your project and actions that you're taking, or just thoughts that you're having about what you're doing.
That was a great question, Adam. I can't wait to hear his answer.
No, I mean, I grew up on this farm, and I was homeschooled and spent most of my life kind of barefoot wandering through the woods, and was always really into wild plants. I was really into like edible wild plants when I was a kid. That was like a big obsession of mine. Yeah. And you know, apples were a big part of my childhood too. We had all these wild apple trees that I've mentioned before, and every fall we would gather apples and we would make cider. Not necessarily hard cider, although, you know, as the fall went on, the cider would start to ferment as cider does, and it would become, you know, a little bubbly, and we called it fizzy cider, and we all liked the fizzy cider best. So that's probably my, you know, my initial introduction to semi-hard cider. And so I do have this like deep nostalgic connection to this landscape. And it's been really nice to be back. And I think it's also been nice to be back with Josh, with someone else who didn't grow up here, who has a certain amount of like fresh eyes to see things as well and notice things that maybe I had gotten used to seeing without really asking what that plant was or what was going on there. So that's, there's both like a deep value in the familiarity, but I think also like coming to something with that feels strange to you. And so then you're able to be more curious about it as well. I mean, some of our discoveries have been finding American chestnuts growing in the woods. That's been kind of a new thing. All the mushrooms and kind of like fungal activity that's going on, foraging a bunch of wild edible mushrooms has been really phenomenal. Yeah, what else, Josh, in terms of what we've kind of learned coming back to this landscape?
I think definitely some of the ecology, but I think also kind of realizing how unique the site is kind of in the greater scheme of some of the surrounding area has been fun to nerd out over. You know, we can dig into old glaciated ideas of us being kind of on the edge of a previous glaciation, which
the most recent glacier is, you know, extended just about to where we are, close to 10,000 years ago. And so we're sort of on the edge of that landscape that was really impacted by it and created the Finger Lakes. But our land probably was not impacted by that. So we have a very interesting, like super hard pan clay soil, rather than some of the glacial till and, you know, sort of more directly exposed shale that you find in other places.
Yeah, I think being friends with so many local winemakers talking about shale and bedrock and gravelly
glacial till
all the time, I'm always just constantly like, I can't relate because we just have clay and
hard impenetrable clay.
Yeah, that apples seem to love.
Wow.
Is
that because of the elevation? Sorry.
It is. So funny enough, when I was working in 2022 for this local winery, there was a local history teacher that came through and he started to talk about these things. And I mentioned, you know, where the land is that Charlie and I are living on and the elevation, which is roughly starts around 1700 feet and goes up to 1900 feet. And he was like, oh yeah, that's why you have clay, because that was never scraped by this most recent period of glaciation. So I thought that was pretty fun. I stumbled upon something online one time that I'm not sure if Charlie had been familiar with, which is that we're the land that we own that you visited where we had food is kind of divided in half by one of the smaller continental divides, which was kind of funny to nerd out over.
Right.
So yep. Water on one side of our land goes one to one watershed and the other goes...
One goes into the St. Lawrence Seaway and the other eventually ends up in the Chesapeake.
Yep.
So that's kind of fun. Right.
It's like a fun nerdy moment about this land.
And then one of the other interesting things about the elevation, we've found that we are in general a couple weeks behind the valley in terms of when things start to flower and bud in the spring. And that's actually been helpful to us this most recent year. There was a pretty devastating frost event that killed, destroyed the flowers and little baby fruits for many of the local, you know, orchards. But for some reason, I think partially because of how windy it is up on our kind of high ridge elevation, And then also probably because we weren't as far along in terms of the development mm-hmm. of the trees and the fruit, we were totally fine and had a massive crop. Even though, you know, the vineyard we work for that's like a mile away yeah. had, you know, 70% loss. So it's right. been really cool to sort of learn some of those unique aspects about being on this, what otherwise seems like a pretty inhospitable, like a cold, barren yes. clay hilltop.
Often in the winter, we'll have yeah. snow and drive down into the town that we live in, and there's no snow at all. And we're just like, wow, people are experiencing a very different winter than we are.
Yeah.
So,
what about what you're doing gives you the most joy right now?
I think, you know, this is Charlie. For me, there's kind of, I'd say there's like three things. One is just the opportunity to be outside. Like I, in yeah. previous yeah. life, have worked in offices and, you know, a sort of normal American work schedule where I'm just like inside most of the time. And so being able to work outside in all different times of the year and to feel myself to be living more in the rhythm of seasonality and weather has been just really healing for me, mentally, emotionally, spiritually. I think another aspect is just the creativity, like the challenge of starting a small business and the creativity that goes into the cider making process, specifically the, you know, tasting and selection of fruit, especially with all the wild fruit we're dealing with, where unlike sort of known grape varieties, where, you know, you coming into Chardonnay, kind of knowing what a Chardonnay grape is and what a Chardonnay should taste like, you know, and maybe you're making accommodations to that specific vintage. We are dealing with apples we've never tasted before and no one has tasted before. And so that is just like such a creative process and deeply gratifying to, you know, have beverages come out of that that are intriguing and delicious and good for pairing with food. So there's that just like kind of art project. Like Josh and I always talk about how like what we're doing is ultimately like a big art project. And that's sort of what life is about and what our farm is about in the end. And then I think on a sort of, I don't know if it's like a sociological or political side, just like the self-determination and being, you know, being more directly involved in making our own living and making our lives work has been so much more satisfying and gratifying than any other job that I've worked before. And I think it might be close to like Marxist ideas of like alienation and things like that, but being like less alienated from the means of production, as it were, I yeah. think in like a really high level has been, I don't know if it's just like, it's not necessarily just makes you happy, but satisfying in a different way to have a big
yeah.
project like this. So I think, I guess off the top of my head, those are for me, but Josh.
Yeah. I mean, Charlie definitely covered a lot of the things I would have said as well. I think being outdoors, doing physical labor that's satisfying at the end of the day has brought a lot of like mental and physical positive things to my life. But I would say things that are bringing me joy.
Ooh, yes.
Definitely the apple breeding projects. This is the first year I'm going to be able to, you know, introduce varieties we've been discovering in this mile radius to our land by grafting and hopefully doing some cross-pollinations with some trees that we discovered last year this spring and gathering yes. those seeds to plant out next year. But I think another side of it, which I don't think I expected going into it, but has been really rewarding and brings a lot of joy, is getting to do a project like this with your life partner. I feel like that's something that I don't know if a lot of people in life get to, you know, be synced up. Is that the right way to say it? Synced up in the way that, you know, we have such similar passions and it really does become a major collaboration every day. Like we're constantly talking about, okay, what is it that your goals for the day? What are my goals for the day? How can we help each other to reach these kind of bigger goals that are 5 to 10 to 20 years down the lane. And then so much of those things revolve around something else that's been really enjoyable, which is bringing all the things we're doing to the greater community around us. We've met so many amazing people in the Finger Lakes that work for different cideries, wineries. You know, everyone's just super friendly, excited for us. We're excited for them. So like being able to be in this industry and actually truly love and care about the people around us in the community brings both of us so much joy. Like I think half the time when we have bottled something or created something new, we're like, okay, who can we gather together to share this with? Cause we, you know, can't wait to get together and nerd out over this thing, or I don't know.
It's a really fun community to be a part of.
It's pretty amazing. Yeah.
This sort of group of people, various ages and backgrounds that, I don't know, if Finger Lakes has kind of a neat vibe right now of like people starting, and you may be part of this soon too, Adam, like starting these really cool projects and getting together and sharing the things that we've made and
poured our blood, sweat, and tears into and really care deeply about.
And I also like being able to do this project with my life partner too. I should have said that.
You say it every day.
Yeah. No, but it is really fun to like be able to go out and, you know, prune a tree together, you know, kind of do that work. And we also have our different areas of focus. You know, you're a little bit more focused on the orchard growing. I'm a little bit more focused on the cider making and that kind of thing as well.
Compliments well.
Yeah.
That's nice. Yeah. I mean, it's fortunate also to get along so well and have similar interests, which is, you know, not always how things align by fortune.
We don't always get along so well. We don't want to pretend
that we're humans.
Yeah.
But there is a running joke that, you know, from the summer we met, we've practically always lived and worked together. So it's worked out pretty well.
I'm learning how many apple trees Josh wants to plant now. So this is, you know.
He's scared now.
Yeah, 300 more trees this spring, babe?
That's nothing. You'll be fine.
Yeah. Nothing for you, my dear.
When
I was with
when we were together, I remember I was talking about sort of getting through the winter with a hibernation ethos. Have you been able to cultivate that this winter? Or I hear it's been a pretty mild winter there, but have you gotten a chance to sort of just snuggle in and hibernate with tea and big woolly sweaters? And I forget what your vision was.
Yeah, I mean, you're right. It has been a more mild winter.
Yeah.
Which, so as someone like myself who is from the South, grew up in Arkansas, you know, I would say the winters here so far have not been to the extent in which I was warned.
Yeah, as brutal as
Charlie grew up with. And then this year specifically has been different because we are both working, you know, for this local winery, Living Roots, throughout the winter. So it's been a positive thing in the sense that it's given our winter a little more of a structure. And a little more of a schedule, and it's forced us to be more social over the winter, which I think helps quite a bit.
Yeah. I'd say there's been some hibernation.
Oh yeah.
Like we've been doing some, you know, some solid napping, and you know, there's a lot of good family Christmas time. But like the, you know, real talk about small business is that there is so much paperwork in terms of taxes, licensing, like getting our farm winery license has been a huge project of the last year. And so, you know, this winter, honestly, we've been trying to force ourselves to work on some of the administrative things, financial and otherwise, that we really need to get set up before we get back into the busy growing season. So I'd say the hibernation is definitely an aspiration. And we've done some of it, but we're also dreaming of years to come where we might be able to do a little travel in the winter as well when the farm is less demanding. But this year, I mean, Josh has been Josh has a graphic design background, an art background. And so he's been designing our labels and website and a lot of those kind of nitty-gritty stuff that you need as a small business.
Yes.
Yeah, we were talking about sort of like what our farming approach is the other day, and like, you know, we're not currently certified in any way, but the farm that we're working on that my grandparents bought back in the 70s, you know, they were very interested in organic and natural farming. So there really has never been any spraying or anything like that going on. And our ultimate dream would be to not even do sort of traditional, you know, quote unquote, conventional organic sprays. And sort of we've toyed with the idea of like a Taoist approach to farming in the sense of like sort of going with the flow. Like maybe you are working as a shepherd or like helping to gently, you know, encourage and direct the trees and the landscape in a way that, you know, that you desire from your human perspective, but that you're working with the grain of the universe, as it were. Not to get too
philosophical,
highfalutin.
Yeah.
No, I was looking for this. I'm glad you brought it up just now. I mean, really, that was my next question was going to be to try to draw that out of you. But when you mean that, you mean essentially even organic orcharding right now tends to use a lot of sprays, again, because there are these selected varieties of cider apples that are, you know, considered delicious, but not necessarily as resilient as, like, for example, some of the wild apples or the feral apples that you're finding on your farm. And you're kind of leaning more towards that direction. Is that right? You're leaning more towards, let's use these things that can grow, that have been growing here until we showed up just fine. And we're picking apples from them and pears from them and making delicious cider from them. So why don't we just do more of that? Am I characterizing that correctly?
I think that's accurate. You know, that's a big part of it. And a big influence for us was just realizing that this land already, you know, it already was producing fruit. You know, going all the way back to my childhood when we would go and pick these wild apples that had never been tended or pruned in any way and make, you know, hundreds of gallons of cider. So I think that's a big part of it. I think at the same time, though, another big reason for the sort of sprays and more interventionist approaches is that you're trying to achieve a more consistent crop every year as well. And so, you know, these wild trees aren't necessarily going to produce every single year. You know, there's, you know, intense biennialism at times as well. And also, I think something you've talked about before is that, you know, apples kind of tend to thrive in more of like a forest edge. You know, they're sort of like part of that successional pattern. And so they're, I wouldn't want to say that there isn't a place for humans, which, you know, humans have been doing ever since we were human, of like trying to shape landscapes in ways that work for us, but that are also healthy and work for the landscapes themselves as well. So I think, I don't know if we know yet exactly where we're going to land on that, but we have a strong bias against just sort of assuming that we need to spray on a certain schedule or intervene in certain ways. And maybe there are ways to shape our business where we don't need as consistent a crop. You know, maybe we're able to make cider and also perhaps distill cider and produce, you know, sort of more shelf stable products as well, or aged products that can kind of smooth out those cycles. So I think that's kind of a big area of exploration for us, is how exactly to make that work. But the sort of germ of the idea was simply seeing that without any human intervention at all, fruit, really good fruit, was being produced. Is that fair, Josh?
Yeah, and I think my apprehension as the person who's kind of taking on the orcharding side of things is, if all of this is already occurring on this land, and we're talking, you know, on the immediate family land, 500 wild trees, if you're talking the mile radius where, you know, neighbors are allowing us to also harvest wild fruit, you know, you're getting another 100 trees probably. And so I don't want to jump into spraying things that could potentially throw the ecological balance that's been happening out of sync. I would rather observe, watch, take our time, and like only intervene in ways that maybe are coaxing it back to a healthy direction.
In terms of like clearing out around those trees, cutting dead wood, pruning them, sort of gently.
Yeah, it's all... I think it's, yeah, I think for me and Charlie...
mild disturbance.
Exactly, yeah. We're not coming in to, like, strong-arm things.
And we're also, I guess another aspect is we're working on comparatively an extremely tiny scale.
Yes.
So we're, you know, we're intentionally wanting to have a business that is small so that we can maintain quality and that it can be site-specific and it can be sustainable. So, you know, we're doing this on a small scale. We're hoping that it's going to be something that's able to also be a livelihood for us as well as producing something really good for other people. And it's also, I think, another aspect where the kind of spraying you were talking about comes in, Adam, as far as I understand it, is just like the, people in general are shooting for like an efficiency of yield per acre, sort of maximizing the number of trees that you can,
right.
can have per acre and the amount of fruit that you can get from those. And so the way that we're approaching it in that sense is never really going to be super efficient. On the other hand, we're also hopefully not going to have to invest in the same type of equipment and inputs either. And so that's
right.
And hopefully we are also creating a really healthy ecosystem.
Yeah.
So, I mean, one of the things that you just brought up a bunch of interesting things, but this idea of like, yes, it's smaller and like, you know, the question that I like to now ask of everybody who I interview for the podcast is sort of like to play devil's advocate with yourself, like, and your approach to life basically, and like talk about what the weaknesses are. But I think you already sort of acknowledged that in what you're saying, that it's like, you know, it's small, it is the, and you also don't have answers necessarily to the questions. And so you're already asking those questions by just doing the things, like trying to figure out how to actually survive and make a living doing what you're doing. And it could work out, it could not work out. That's part of the potential.
Yes,
but
come back to us in a couple of years, Adam.
Yeah, follow up interview.
And it's really tough. I mean, from, you know, I've been there. You know, I'm 5 years into a small business myself. I mean, but you also brought up some really interesting things that I think people forget, which is like, if it is a low input system, like the output, you know, the outcomes don't have to be as large as well. You know, you can, it's like, if you don't take on massive debt, then you can work jobs that you love, even if they pay poorly, because you don't need all this income to cover it. And I think, I don't know, that's sort of like an analogy really, but I mean, maybe that's also true to farming. But I like that. I like that idea. Do you have any other doubts or questions or insights like that about, you know, benefits, pros and cons to approaching the small farm world that you're doing?
I think one of the things that we end up talking a lot about that is particular to probably wine and cider and similar value-added products of that type is questions about accessibility and who has the ability to pay for these products. And, you know, are mm-hmm. we essentially producing a luxury good? I don't think cider or wine should be considered that way. I think it should be something that is accessible to everyone and is part of a happy and full life. But you do see, I mean, I think especially on the more, you know, smaller production, organic, you know, end of the spectrum, that things tend to be pretty expensive. And so there's sort of some bigger questions there about who is it for? So I think that's a question, in addition to what we talked about in terms of, is this whole approach to farming something that can work more, you know, more broadly? Not that we want to grow and scale up, but is it something that could, you know, obviously we're not going to feed the world with cider specifically, but, you know, having 7 or 8 billion people on the planet, you know, what are the forms of agriculture that, you know, really work on when you're talking about that kind of scale? So I think those are just like really big questions that are really hard to answer, but we definitely think about a lot.
Yeah, that is a good one. I don't know what the answer to that is either.
We're on the one hand, people, you know, incomes have not been rising in proportion to the cost of things. And then also that we're very used to extremely cheaply produced agricultural products imported from far, far away. And just like you're saying, I mean, we're, you know, the potential price of our cider doesn't reflect like some crazy inflated thing. It's just like we're doing this on a super small scale. And so it just takes a lot of time. And, you know, we're picking up all the apples by hand in, you know, burlap sacks. Like, it's just a lot of time and effort. And so that is just what it costs.
No, I think one of the things that is core to this project we're taking on is the fact that a question like that is something we try to ask ourselves often. Like, it's one of the things that we keep at the front of our mind so that we are trying to keep our consumer in mind, whether that's financially or, you know, being two gay farmers and accessibility to farming and that kind of a lifestyle that, you know, is quite foreign to most queer people in the world because they don't feel welcome. So doing what we can every step of the way to kind of remind ourselves of the core of our project, which is, you know, some of these things that are very important to us as humans, and making sure not to let some of those other things get in the way of that.
Yeah. And I mean, I think another way to think about accessibility is the way that, even not just in relationship to price, although this is part of it, but just like the sort of class and language around wine specifically, that, you know, isn't necessarily accessible. And so I think there is some sweet spot where you can really enjoy intriguing, complicated, nuanced beverages in a way that, you know, isn't somehow classist or
ostracizing.
Yeah, exactly. Alienating.
Well, I mean, part of my intention in getting people to get to know producers like you is that we can see how these things that are, you know, maybe it's more handcrafted work, but that's not just so that you can put handcrafted, you know, and use some stupid marketing slogan. It's like these grow out of your values, like what you're doing and the reasons, you know, for the, you know, all of these things that are legitimate and add to the quality, I think, ultimately, of what you're trying to sell aren't just gimmicks. You know, they're not marketing, that they grow out of values that are about, you know, that are ecological, that are, you know, caring about where you are and caring about the people that you work with and the people that you serve and the land that you get to be, you know, a shepherd of, or whatever, you know, whatever the right term is for that. And yeah, so I don't know. I do like that. And I wanted to ask, in terms of just, if somebody is a queer person who wants to know more about farming, like, are you giving access to people to come visit, like, or anybody that wants to just visit or anything like that? Is there a venue for that yet? Or is that a plan? Or are you, you know, what, any response to that that you have?
Yeah, I think right now, I mean, reach out would be the, you know, big thing. Reach out on Instagram, you know, send us a message. Shoot us
where would
email.
They reach out?
So you can find us on Instagram at Sylvan Farm and Cidery. It's SYLVAN Farm and Cidery. Also, that's our website. And sylvancider@gmail.com. Mm-hmm. So feel free to shoot us a message. We're still under construction right now. We're we're building our house slash cidery, and we're hoping this year that we'll be able to do tastings on the farm. And, you know, even if that's a, you know, a little bit of more like a picnic table in the orchard that people can come and visit. Otherwise we will be having our cider available at a few different locations around the Finger Lakes, and certainly available for people to order, online through the website. But certainly we'd love to be able to host people in the future. That's a big part of the long-term vision, because that was such a big part of our experience getting into farming, was living and working on a number of different farms.
Yeah, I would say my background is in education. So my dream would be, once we've gotten things rolling and we've really learned, you know, the lay of our land and production and all those things, to be able to bring in an apprentice. I mean, Charlie obviously gained so much knowledge and community from working at Eve's with Autumn and Ezra. I really lucked out somehow by finding two gay farmers in Arkansas to work for back in 2017. And it just kind of like opened my eyes and showed me a way of life that I didn't really think was available to, you know, someone like myself, a queer person, a gay person in the world. And they had a beautiful lifestyle, and they had figured it out. And, you know, it wasn't all rainbows, but they persevered and have really created an amazing farming community in Northern Arkansas, where they do organic flowers and vegetables and have 4 to 6 interns every year that come in and help work. And it was just a beautiful lifestyle. So if we were able to return that favor to the next generation at some point, that would be a dream come true for sure.
Nice. Beautiful. Well, thank you guys. Is there anything that you wanted to say that I haven't asked you about?
Gosh, ooh, that's a good question.
Covered so many good topics.
It's okay. There's not.
There's anything else that I would say right now.
We should let everyone know that deer fences are very expensive.
Yes.
Oh, what have you found out? Have you gotten some quotes on deer fences?
Yes. Yes, we sure have. And it's just,
do you have a price per acre or price per foot or anything? Do you know?
We have to go back and look at it, but it was like tens of thousands of dollars.
Yeah. Unfortunately. It's one of those things, wow. If you're getting into farming, realize things you probably don't even think about are going to end up being major factors if you're trying to bootstrap it.
Actually, I think I do have sort of one thing that I would like to say. Please. Sorry, Adam, was I cutting you off there?
Nope. I just was saying, wow.
Oh, yeah. So, yeah, I think one additional thing that I would just mention, which I'm sure I know you know, and a lot of our, you know, the people who listen to this podcast certainly already know, is just, I think cider specifically, you know, you're the organic or the Beyond Organic Wine podcast, and you know, you've interviewed a bunch of cider folks, but cider is still such a, I think, new category for a lot of people. And even just the idea that cider is wine in some sense, you know, I would say that's fair. Maybe it's its own category, but it's a beverage that is beautiful, complicated, worthy to be paired with food. I think I've just really like fallen in love with what cider can actually be. And that's, you know, been through a lot of amazing producers in the Finger Lakes for sure. Autumn and Eric, and, you know, all kinds of people making amazing beverages like that. And I think that's just like another real passion for us, is to like see cider get some respect, but really just cider be appreciated for what it can be, especially coming from, you know, small, careful producers, wherever they are in the world as well. So I just want to throw that in at the end as well. I know we've been talking a lot about the farming practices, but just that sort of more cultural side of, I think there's still a lot of education taking place in terms of what cider is and what it can be, not necessarily in terms of your audience, but in the world.
Well, it's, I mean, you've had Autumn as a mentor, and she's kind of like, I would say the OG in that area and in our nation in terms of
Oh, like, yeah.
Treating cider like a like the finest of fine beverages and making cider that that demands respect. So you have a great a great mentor in that sense. And then you referenced Eric. I guess you meant Eric Schatt, right?
Definitely. I meant Eric Schatt, although I could also say Eric Bordelais as well in France, another fantastic cider. I definitely meant Eric Schatt, yes. Yeah. Who I also think is making great ciders, and you know, there's
amazing stuff. Well. Yeah, I mean, I can't think of. I don't want to shit on anybody else's cider, but like that, the area that you're in is producing, I think, some of the most world class cider that that our country produces, and it should be. I hope more and more it becomes known for that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And to be honest, that was a big part ultimately of why we moved here even was because that was happening. And, you know, because we knew there was the possibility for that. And that those were sort of the footsteps that we wanted to follow in a way, not that we don't want to do site specific ciders that express the terroir of our landscape and the wild apples that we're talking about. So it's, you know, it's obviously not identical, but those are the people we want to learn from.
Yeah. Well, cool. Thank you so much for sharing your Friday night with me. It's been great talking to you guys.
A pleasure. Yeah. Thanks, Adam. It's always great.
Hey, you made it. I hope you enjoyed that. And if you did make it this far, you might want to know how to learn more. So the website where you can learn more is beyondorganicwine.com. All the past issues are listed there. Issues. It's like a magazine. No, this is a podcast. All the past episodes, almost all the past episodes, going back 2 or 3 years, and then some really good ones from the beginning are there. Are not there, but they are available. They're just not listed yet because it's a lot of work to bring up these things from the past. To bring them up from the past. Anyway, I just have not had the time to add all the past episodes onto the website, but they do exist in podcast land, so they are available. And I would just, you know, go to your podcast app and scroll back through the 150 or so episodes as of now, which is March 2024, that you can listen to. It's an amazing library of things, no fault of my own. It's just some incredible people said yes, and I'm very fortunate that they did, and so that I could record them and offer them to you to listen to. And if in any way you'd like to support this work and this library and this growing library and support the growing of this library, that is so vital and desperately needed and so important to making this possible for me to do this. Even though I love doing it, it does take actual stuff, energy, time, money, and resources to be able to make it possible. So that support is incredibly important, and that's also at beyondorganicwine.com. So go there, you can see the support page. You can also, our Patreon subscription is listed in the show notes for this episode, and ways you can donate, or just ways that you can support without costing you any money, which are simple and easy and actually incredibly value to the podcast. So thank you, and check out beyondorganicwine.com.